Title for today is The Appointed End, Death, taken from that astonishing verse in Hebrews 9, where the writer says it is appointed unto all men once to die. So that today we're going to talk together for a few minutes about an appointment that everybody here has got to keep. It doesn't matter how busy you are, it doesn't matter if you're the managing director whose diary is full for many years to come, you've got to keep this appointment whether you like it or not, sooner or later. The appointment of death. Now, I'm not going to talk so much negatively of death this morning as we did a little earlier this autumn, seeing in it the wages of sin. I want to begin this morning by putting before you two clear pictures of what death means to two different people. And I think that as you look at these two pictures, you may decide which you want. And the first picture is in 2 Timothy 4, and you may care to turn up in the New Testament, though it isn't necessary to do so because I'm actually going to look at only one word in the picture. 2 Timothy chapter 4 is read to us by Arthur Shorten a moment ago, and in it we have the words of the Apostle Paul, knowing that he's coming to the end of his life, conscious that the end of his life is not going to be very comfortable, he's going to be sacrificed for his work. But then he says something very striking. He says, "The time of my departure has come," analysis, a very remarkable Greek word that has a great history. We use all sorts of words and euphemisms, don't we, to describe death, passing on, and so on. Some of them are more satisfactory than others. I was reading the life of Archbishop William Temple a little time ago, and twice when walking around the garden with his wife, he commented on the phrase that Christians are promoted to higher service. And he said he wasn't very happy with that phrase, because he said there is no higher service than to obey God here where I am today. But he said he would be agreeable to the phrase wider service, because there are hints in the New Testament that many of the shackles and impediments will be taken off us in the life of the world to come, so that we shall be able to serve and worship Christ more worthily. Now, I think it's possible to have a sort of folklore, traditional number of words we use, which are not at all satisfactory like that. So it's rather interesting to see the type of words that the great apostles of Christianity used. What words did they use to describe their death or dissolution physically? Well, here is the word, analysis, which means departure, and is used in four different ways at least in the literature of St. Paul's time. First, it's a seaman's word. If you were in the Navy or if you have a dinghy, you will appreciate this word. There are very few more thrilling moments when you unloose your moorings and set sail, then you're on your own. You've no longer got the comfortable feeling that you're tied up alongside, and you launch out. Now that is perhaps in the mind of St. Paul when he talks about his departure. It's a voyage of discovery. Secondly, it was used commonly in the literature of his day as a ploughman's word, when the ploughman at the end of the day unloosed a weary team of oxen or animals that they might have refreshment and rest at the end of the day. And again, Paul may have had this in his mind, that at the end of a lifetime of service, we need some rest and refreshment. Then it was also used as a traveller's word. This will appeal to any of you who are campers and can't afford hotels as yet. You take your camp, your tent with you, and you set it up at night, and you strike it in the morning, and you strike it in order to walk on, to make progress, to continue your holiday. And this word was used possibly by the Apostle Paul with this thought in mind, that his death was a striking of his tent, that he might make progress in the future. The word is also used by a philosopher, and this I think is even more interesting. You see, the word literally means an unloosing or unraveling, and the philosopher had many problems, knotty problems in his head, that he couldn't unloose and unravel, like you have in the morning if you do the Daily Mirror quick crossword, or if you let everybody see that you're doing the Times. Now, you probably find before you get to London Bridge that there are many knotty problems you can't unloose or unravel. And this is the meaning of this Greek word. And what Paul is saying is that when he dies, all the problems will be unloosed and unraveled. So that an early Christian is reported to have said in the early centuries of the church's history, "A dead child knows all that has puzzled the sages." That's rather a tremendous thought, isn't it? That all the puzzles and problems that even Christians have on earth vanish away at the time of our departure. No wonder, therefore, that with these thoughts in his mind, the Apostle Paul found himself constantly in a quandary, whether he should stay on earth and help the Christians, or whether he should go to be with Christ, which he said was gain. By the way, he uses the down-to-earth word there in the Greek of profit in business. And he says that death for him will be profit, because it will include all these things. And he never quite knows which is best, to live, which he thoroughly enjoys, or to go to be with Christ, which is even more profitable. Now, having said that, given this little picture of how Paul saw the end of his life, I don't want to over-sentimentalize it. Paul, nor any of the New Testament writers, discount the ugliness of death. And death is still an enemy, even for a Christian. It's still a sign of the dislocation there is in this universe. He says here it's a sacrifice. And John Bunyan, interestingly enough, in his picture of the Christian's pilgrimage, although he's come very nearly to the celestial city, makes the river a dark river which he has to cross. And that's true to experience. There's none of the complacent guff in the New Testament that you get in Christian Science, for example. You probably all know the silly little rhyme. There was a faith healer of Deal who said, although pain isn't real, when I sit on a pin and it punctures my skin, I dislike what I fancy I feel. And I think most of us, however far advanced we are as Christians, dislike what we fancy death may mean. And that is not unspiritual, nor is it unnatural. When I had a heavy cold this morning, Sally Toft told me it was all in the mind. So if any of you would like to have a talk to her, I should be very grateful. I think it's all in my head, but not in my mind. So there's none of that kind of talk that you get of trying to sort of dissolve the realities of life in sentiment in the New Testament. But despite the fact that this death ahead is something which is not altogether pleasant for anyone, yet to Paul it is a wonderful departure onto a new and exciting journey. Now then, by contrast, let's look at the other picture. And if you have a New Testament near you, you may like to turn to the third Gospel, St. Luke's Gospel, in the 12th chapter. Again, don't worry if you'd rather not, because the story I'm going to mention is a very well-known one, the story of the rich fool. The man, you remember, who had a problem because he had so much produce on his farm and decided to build greater barns. And then when he was planning all this in his study with his accountant and banker and the builder and the architect and so on, in verse 20, God said to him, "You fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you've prepared, whose will they be?" This is an astonishing contrast, this story. If the appointment for Paul was welcome, by the way, you say, that's all very well. He was a great, great Christian. But he also said, if you remember at the end of that phrase, this is for all those who love his appearing. He said, if you follow in Paul's steps at all, then for you also it is a welcome appointment, even though we may be timid about it. Yet for this man, by contrast, it's a most unwelcome appointment, most undesirable. And I'll tell you why. This man, I think, characterizes the man of today who's not a Christian. The appointment, first of all, was unexpected. We all of us hate things bursting in on our program, don't we? We all of us hate things that are unexpected, at least most of us do. And he had just said, verse 19, "Soul, you've ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease." And God said, not many years, this night your soul is required of you. Now, death is unexpected. It's an appointment that comes across my pathway when I'm not ready for it. And you may be inclined to say, surely that's not so generally. Obviously it's so with a motor accident. It's obviously so with a coronary. But what about the people who die in hospital at the end of a life? Well, as I've been thinking about my own ministry in the last 15 years, the thing that has struck me as I've looked back is the fact that even to them, death is always, nearly always, unexpected. And I found my own thoughts strongly confirmed by the words of one of our modern agnostics, G.M. Carstairs, whom you may have heard on television, who has written a foreword to the Pelican original on dying, and these are his words. At the same time, he says, we have seen a sharp decline in the authority of traditional religious belief. For most people, the decay of religious belief has not prompted any alternative philosophy. Instead of trying to answer the ultimate questions, they have simply tended to postpone or ignore them. As a result, says Carstairs, and he's not a believer, when death does come, it tends to catch us more than ever unprepared. Now, he is, as far as I know, a man who has a great deal of knowledge and experience from psychiatric work in this field. So striking, isn't it, that his observation says people are more and more unprepared because without a philosophy to face it, they can't face it, like the government with devaluation. We all say we were prepared, but everybody knows that we're not really. And so though we may talk about this, we're not really prepared. And we're so unprepared that even the doctors feel compelled to connive to give a false impression more often than not. So that my job, for example, when I visit people who are elderly and near the end of life, is made almost impossible, because it is virtually the done thing to keep this from everybody. So it comes unexpectedly. And what else can we hope if we have no Christian philosophy? It is unnatural to want to face it. But the appointment for this natural pagan, the rich fool, was not only unexpected, shatteringly sudden, but it was very unwelcome because it turned every calculation upside down. And I think we need to face the fact that death for the vast majority of people, especially those who are not believing Christians, does turn every calculation upside down. No amount of soft language can alter this. For example, there are some delightfully up-to-date pictures in this story. You see, he's got a great problem. He's worrying in his study. He thinks to himself, what shall I do? And then he makes up his mind what he will do, and he says, oh, that will make me happy when I've done it. Now, can't you imagine meeting his wife? His wife would say, well, you know, Bill's very worried at the moment. Tremendous pressure. Got all these goods here, and he's got to know what to do with them. Very worrying time we're going through. I'm looking forward to when we can give the farm to Norman. Then we can get it off our plate. But Bill's got it all worked out, and after this very worrying time, we hope to be able to retire, you see. That's how she talked, probably. And this appointment came along and turned the whole apple cart upside down. He had the worry and no future. There's another part of the picture. He's a man with security on his mind, just as you are. Indeed, many of you make your living through dealing with this fact that we feel insecure and we need security, and well and good. But he wanted security absolutely doubly certain, and I think he argued to himself something like this. He said, well, a slump is pretty likely. He said, land is safe, so I'll stick to my farm, keep it in the family, and then I'll be absolutely certain of having security, and my wife after me. And then this appointment comes of death, and this turns everything upside down. He hasn't got any security after all. Has his wife got security? Well, there's a question, isn't it? Jesus says, whose will these be that you've prepared? Probably he'd forgotten to make a will. Now, my imagination is, of course, running away with me, but you see, he's characteristic, isn't he, of the man who has no horizon more than this life. He's got a legitimate gain from his farm, but this has captivated him. He doesn't think about the future, but the future suddenly advances on him. He's determined to keep his lawful gains. He calls them my barn, my goods, my grain, my things. And so he says, I'm going to hold on to them. They're lawfully mine. You're not going to take them away from me. Taxation's pretty bare, but I'm going to keep this. And what does God say? The appointment comes and they're all taken out of his hands. Did you see in the Evening Standard how much Mr. S left? Said a city man. No, said his friend. I didn't see it in the paper, but I know. Oh, how much was it? Everything. And that's the truth, isn't it? The appointment came and he left everything behind. Wasn't his at all. Now, that's not just a clever little story. This is the truth, isn't it? The appointment came to him long before he was expecting it. It was unexpected. It knocked all awry, his security arrangements, his pleasure in his possessions, and his future. Now, you object to me, and I objected as I was preparing this for this morning. Surely, if you put these two pictures alongside one another, they're far too white and black, black and white. We're not in the position of the Apostle Paul, and we're not in the position of this very foolish pagan. And the more I thought about it, the more I agreed with this objection to a certain extent. It seems to me that very few Englishmen have a black and white view of death. No, we have a kind of grey middle view, don't we? And in our post-Christian society, we have just enough Christianity to make us feel that death cannot mean an ultimate loss. But we haven't got enough Christianity to make us feel that death is definitely a gain. Haven't you noticed this yourself in life? It's neither one or the other. Nobody's clear at all. Then as I looked at the New Testament, I thought to myself, well, I'll get some different pictures if I can, some more complicated pictures. These seem too simple. And I couldn't find them. And I found that it's very interesting. The Bible, when it is talking about the beginning of Christian life and the end of life, is black and white. You're either with Christ or against him. Your death is either loss or profit. In the middle, the Bible recognizes the complexity of life and the very different guidance we shall need in different situations. It's very striking to see that when you get to the end, however, the Bible doesn't deal in complexities at all. It's black and white again. Loss and gain. Profit, loss. And that's exactly what Jesus said. What shall we gain? What shall we profit if we lose our souls? Now, with this in mind, let me make, if I may, two final comments. This simple picture that the Bible gives us of such a glorious profit if we believe in Christ as we come to that appointment, so that even that appointment in our books doesn't worry us and concern us and cast us down. Such profit if we're with Christ. And yet if we're without Christ, such loss. This truth presented to us throws a flood of light on present-day values. I would say to you, with this in mind, how different is the Christian's view of misfortune? Now, please don't misunderstand me here. I believe that to a Christian, death can be a very great tragedy, a very great sorrow, just as it is to his unbelieving neighbor. But the more I think of it and the more I see life, it seems to me that in Christ, for a Christian, this kind of sorrow is never final. Misfortune isn't bounded by death. It's not taken up by this subject. Now, the modern pagan view is that death is the great enemy and the great misfortune. Anything rather than that is the modern intellectual view. So you get political, better red than dead. So you get the idiocy of putting yourself in an iced coffin, hoping somebody will discover how to cure the disease you died of. You see, all this shows a pagan atmosphere creeping over us in the Western world, which says that death is the ultimate thing, let's keep it at arm's length. It's very interesting that society and science has now put it right at arm's length from us, and we're facing a further problem, aren't we? People being kept alive who don't really want to be. Never seem to be able to solve our problems, do we? And underneath it all is often the pagan idea that this is the ultimate tragedy. But for a Christian, no, it's not. What is the ultimate tragedy for a Christian? The ultimate tragedy for a Christian is to die unprepared, spiritually alienated from God. That's the tragedy. So that the ultimate tragedy for the pagan young person is war, but the ultimate tragedy for the Christian young person is sin. Now, what are you fighting to stop in this country? War? Pain and suffering? Or sin in the first place? A great deal is going to depend on your answer to that question. Because the thing that's eating this country's heart out is sin. That's the misfortune. And how different also does it make our viewpoint of happiness? We know very well that a certain amount of money is very helpful and that life isn't very easy if you haven't got any. But there comes a level of affluence that most of us achieve, beyond which there is no real relation between the additions in our bank balance and the additions in our happiness. And that Jesus warns of us in this chapter in verse 15 by saying, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And he's warning us that what makes us rich is not taking but giving, not taking with no future but giving with the realization that in the future I shall be richer still. And I believe that this is really the purpose why God plants this city church in the middle of the city. Because you and I have such great riches to give to our friends. Riches that they haven't dreamt of. The riches of sharing what we have here in this life. Gladly giving it to others who need it when we have enough. And the pleasure of laying up treasure for the life of the world to come. And we want to share that happiness and that pleasure and that fortune with others. So there's nothing negative about the Christian view. The moment a Christian looks at death, he sees one more of the privileges of being a Christian, that Jesus has taken the sting right out of it. And he's told us that ahead there's a life of great excitement, depth, glory. But he says, I hope you'll be rich to enjoy it. Don't come as a pauper.